Welcome to our discussion segment on the War of 1812. I'm John Streeter.
And I'm Joe Parker.
And today we're talking about blundering into war, the War of 1812. Let's get started.
All right, John. War of 1812.
Yes.
I've been excited about this
another of
discussion.
The forgotten wars, along with the French and Indian War. We don't tend to think too much about it.
I think the French and Indian War is a little bit more forgotten than this one. Because, I mean, you think about...
You just like your podcast better than mine, right?
Yeah. Well, in terms of the War of 1812, my mind instantly goes to two things. Oliver Hazard Perry.
Yes.
And the burning of Washington.
Not the Star-Spangled Banner?
Well, it's just when you think about the burning of Washington, D.C., it seems almost apocalyptic.
In a
today's,
good way?
No, no, no. In today's standards. Like, you only see that in movies... that are terrible, like,
yeah, that's
like
true.
Action movies or like the world,
Independence Day,
Independence
things like
Day.
That. Yeah, you're right.
Or do you remember that Kevin Costner film, The Postman?
I never saw it.
Don't.
Okay,
it's real bad. He's a great actor, I think, but just not the best.
I think the season is like history in movies. This whole thing.
Yeah. That's what comes to my mind when I think of the War of 1812.
Sure.
And I'm sure that our audience also has like their own images of the war
absolutely.
And all that stuff. So. In terms of the events leading up to war, you did a great job, I think, of just kind of setting the context of not only what was going on overseas, what pushed Great Britain into telling American sailors, hey, you're now part of our service now.
Yep.
And
although that was common British practice for at least a half century before, and it wasn't because of the Napoleonic Wars.
Oh, okay. So it
they were doing that before there was even a French Revolution.
So it wasn't because they were short on sailors
no.
and everything.
Okay. No, that was standard British. The idea of freedom of the seas that we think of today, the sea is free for the innocent passage of all, did not exist until 1919 and the Treaty of Versailles.
Okay.
Yeah, it was basically whichever ship had the biggest guns would be able to board smaller ships and take whatever they wanted.
Ah, so that's one of the
especially
reasons why...
Especially if they were British.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's one of the reasons why I think the British had such a big navy. Because
yes.
there's so many people being willing to
get
on a ship and get rich from the fact that they
One in five, I think, of the sailors in the British Navy at its height was impressed.
Wow.
They were grabbed, and it was... You're a sailor in the English Navy until you can prove your citizenship. Well, most people didn't have passports or any kind of citizenship papers. They couldn't do anything.
Oh.
Yep.
Interesting. So in terms of that part of it, and then just the state of the American Army and the
lack of an American Army.
American Army. I mean, we had a Navy, sort of.
Six rowboats.
It's like, what a mess.
Yeah.
Like, so why, what was the rationale... I'm sorry, what was the belief that this was a good idea considering the current state of things?
Because, just like in the Revolution, Britain is occupied with events in Europe. It was thought we could grab some or all of Canada, and we could, that's what the War Hawks wanted, we can reassert ourselves on the high seas, and Britain is distracted, so we'll take what we can.
Okay.
And it didn't work out all that well.
Yeah. So even though, so there were discussions, though, about the state of the Army, about the state of the Navy, about, I mean...
There were discussions in the Army and Navy, or in the War and Navy departments. I don't know that President Madison knew a whole lot about the state of the military, because President Madison is a textbook case for how not to lead a country into war. Hmm. He was utterly unprepared. Brilliant man. In terms of politics, he wrote large portions of the Constitution, first draft turned into final draft... Utterly brilliant, but utterly incompetent in the military arts. He was 5'4", thus too short to serve in the Continental Army. I don't believe he had any service, or if he did, it was certainly not in the line. He didn't really understand logistics at all. He was not a particularly popular president. This was not a particularly popular war. We'll see that when we talk about the burning of Washington. There are some interesting anecdotes and stories to talk about that. But yeah, I don't think he knew the full state of unreadiness of the military in 1812.
Okay, obviously not. So in terms of the war on land, man, we really hated Canada.
we hated the British.
Yeah,
I think, I mean, we
I
saw ourselves as liberators. It was almost like Canada had some oil somewhere elsewhere in the world, and we're here to liberate you. No, that's been America's tradition of going into countries that don't want to be liberated and saying, hi, we're here to save you. And the locals say, we're fine, thanks.
Well, except for the French in the Second World War.
the rare exception that proves the rule twice.
Yeah, so in terms of...
I'm talking about offensive wars. I'm not talking about us.
Yeah, we were attacked.
So
in terms of our first strides into Canada, I read a very long quote by General Hull.
Yes.
Just in terms of his arrogance in going into Canada, was that true arrogance? Was that just his lack of experience? Where he just thought, I'm bringing the powers that be with me. Mm-hmm. Hey, Canadians, stand out of my way and everything will be fine. What?
I think he is. He had to realize. I don't know all that much about General William Hull outside of his War of 1812 service, which was pretty short and pretty disastrous. But he had to believe, or he had to understand, that his army was not large enough to conquer Canada. 1,200 men is not enough to take even just the small bits of Canada that were settled at that point. He had to believe that this was going to be a token force that was going to spark an uprising of the Canadian people against their British overlords, and that the Canadian people would do the majority of the fighting. And this message was basically, we're here to liberate you, either stay in your homes or join us in the rebellion. But if you attack us, what did he say? Instant destruction will be your lot?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it was him tragically misunderstanding the sentiments of the Canadian people, rather than him just thinking, we're Americans, we're going to come in with a tiny army and plant the flag and the world will fall before us. He's not Napoleon.
Yeah. So in terms of his advance into Canada and then retreat from Canada to deal with the Shawnee uprising.
Couple days later.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It just didn't seem like there was a lot of thinking through the entire process of doing what he was doing.
I don't think he considered the Shawnee a threat.
Okay.
Which was really stupid, because the Shawnee had been a threat even after the Battle of Tippecanoe. The Shawnee were still a threat and one that needed to be watched. I think he expected the Ohio, Indiana, and Kentucky militias to handle that, and that he wouldn't have to deal with it. And when the Shawnee rose up and General Harrison wasn't able to gather troops quickly enough to deal with it, and he had to face them, that he wasn't expecting that.
Gotcha.
I'm happy to criticize, you know, military leaders when they deserve it. I don't know that Hull deserves...
So
maybe you're giving them.
Maybe he'll deserve a little bit more after we talk about this. Why did he surrender to the British force?
If memory serves, I think it was because he thought it was much larger than it actually was. I mean, after hearing about the Shawnee Rebellion, he assumed there had to be tens of thousands of Shawnee in the forest beyond what he could see. He didn't have any scouts outside Detroit looking to see what was there. I would imagine either that or it was military incompetence, that his will was so utterly broken when the Canadian people rose up, not against the British, but against him, that he just said, all right, well, war's over.
Yeah. Yeah, it was.
And I'm sure he wanted to save the lives of his men. I mean, as a military commander, that's one of your first duties.
Yeah. Yeah, so strategically speaking, was the strategy, we're going to go into Canada, take control of that whole area first, and then so that we don't have that front, and then the sea, like people.
Yeah.
So that was the plan. Obviously, it didn't go according to plan because he backtracked after he invaded. Then he surrendered. And so now we have Harrison deciding, okay, we need to attack again.
Right.
So in each war you read about in history, there's like epiphany moments where you realize, okay, what we've been doing so far has not been effective.
Mm-hmm.
Was Harrison the one that had that when? Because he was pretty successful.
He was. But Harrison was not interested in conquering Canada.
Okay.
Harrison's war was entirely defensive. It was reconquering land that the Shawnee and Tecumseh had already captured. Now, he eventually pursued Tecumseh into Canada. The Battle of the Thames is fought on Canadian soil, not on American soil. But it's a completely different mindset between Harrison and Hull. Not necessarily saying one is better than the other. Certainly one was more successful than the other. But Harrison's sole objective is not go take stuff from the enemy, it's retake what they have taken from us.
Okay.
And that's why he was more successful. He also understood Indian warfare. Hull did not understand Indian warfare. So the fighting behind rocks and trees, Hull is a 19th century military commander, you fight in line and column.
Yeah.
Which doesn't work.
Yeah. So
I do think, kind of an interesting counterfactual, just very quickly, I think America hit the wrong part of Canada. And it was logistically the only part they could attack at that point. But if they had invaded Quebec instead of Ontario, with that local French population already being extremely anti-British, there's a better chance of success going in through that part of Canada, sealing the mouth of the St. Lawrence River, and then taking, you know, going down the St. Lawrence and taking Canada that direction. Might have worked. But again, the Canadian people didn't want to be conquered
yeah.
or liberated, so I don't think it would have worked.
Yeah. So in terms of the land war, Canadian campaign, we go into Ontario, we burn the capital city of York, which is now modern-day Toronto.
Toronto, yep.
And this campaign up to this point has been fairly good, right? Like in terms of the outcome of the war.
Not the raid on, that was a one-hit wonder, basically. Okay. That was not tied to Harrison's campaign. Okay. That was just go across the lake, burn the city, and then leave.
Okay, just because?
Well, because you take or destroy the enemy capital, maybe they'll surrender. I mean, that's traditional military doctrine.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. So, in terms of the war at sea, you talked a lot about the USS Constitution.
I did.
Which is still technically in service, right?
It is. Put a couple Patriot missile batteries on her, sail her over to the Middle East, and she can go fight ISIS.
Yeah no kidding. I liked how you were talking about what her hull was full of when she was fired on, because a lot of people think it was just this engineering marvel.
It was.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of her hull being able to withstand cannon shot at that range, it was pretty demoralizing for the troops that saw it. It's like their cannon fire bouncing off the hull.
Yep.
The force of the cannonball that hits the hull, if it doesn't penetrate the hull, the force has to go somewhere.
Right.
So it goes like through the hull and then out again. So that's why it's called old...
Ironsides, yes. Yeah.
And in terms of that, how much action did this ship see after the War of 1812?
After the War of 1812, none. She was a training ship for a while, then she was laid up, and eventually it was decided, no, we're going to preserve her. And she was turned into a museum, I believe, shortly after the Civil War. If any of our listeners are from Boston, or who are close enough to Boston to go visit, it's incredible to stand on the deck of that ship, to stand at the wheel. If you can actually, she now goes out into the harbor every once in a while. You can go out there. It's on those tours. It's incredible. And as Joe said, still a commissioned vessel in the United States Navy, the oldest commissioned warship still afloat. The only one that's older is HMS Victory, Nelson's great ship from Trafalgar, but she is permanently in a dry dock. She would not make it out to sea anymore.
So, Oliver Hazard Perry, this character in history is a favorite of mine. I just think what he was facing was pretty impossible, and he was able to pull it off. Now, what I have read about the account is when he was commanding and firing on the English ships, he maneuvered his ship between two English ships and pulled off a double broadside onto both of those frigates.
At point blank range. I think there was maybe 10, 15 yards of clearance on either side.
I have this image of the flag going through the smoke and the broadsides of the English firing on his ship and his side just doing it like his cannon crews were split like one on one side, one on the other.
Designed to do.
No. And then he comes out of it and the flag's still like flying at the top of this ship. His ship is shot to crap.
Well, I was going to say, then his ship sank.
Yeah, he had burned and sank.
4/5 of his crew died on that after that broadside, and he had to row back through between those two ships in a little rowboat, which I think is actually more impressive.
Yeah.
Because the British are trying to, you know, lower their guns enough to be able to hit this thing. They can't do it. But he's rowing back, I'm sure, with the little flag on his rowboat still flying.
Yeah, how bold was that? Just the idea is like, you know what we're going to do? We're going to maneuver this thing in between those two ships.
Well, I mean, people did that all the time. That was again, standard military. We don't think of it today because our idea of naval combat is air power and carriers and things like that. But
your
had
gun
to
crews
get close back then.
Well, close was one thing, but firing from both sides, your gun crews were trained to go on one specific side could fire all the guns.
You're right.
He had to space them as like one crew was on one side, one crew was on the other, so he just had to like fire from both sides, which is hard to do. So in terms of the Great Lakes in general, strategically, why was it so imperative for him to hold those and make sure that those were secure?
Because you can attack anywhere. If you think about the geography, basically between the United States and Canada, you've got the St. Lawrence River starting at Quebec, going down to right around Montreal, and then now there's the Seaway, but that didn't exist back then. So you have a brief land bridge between the St. Lawrence River and Lake Ontario. Then you have the tiny little piece of land between Ontario and Erie. That's where Niagara Falls is. And then you have Lake Erie. And then you have the split between Erie and Huron, where Detroit is. Those are the only four areas where you can get an army through, unless you control the Great Lakes. Then you can amphibiously land anywhere you want, either in Canada or in Pennsylvania or New York or Ohio. That's why you need to control the Great Lakes, or at least to deny them to the British.
Great points. In terms of how did they get the ships on the Great Lakes? Because it's not connected to the sea.
Well, they put massive wheels on the ships and just kind of wheeled them over.
Rolled them over land.
No, they built them.
Found a passage.
They built them on the Great Lakes. Those were lake-going vessels.
So it was seen as that important.
That you're gonna invest. It was a huge arms race. I mean, we think of arms races in modern terms, but they had them right there because neither side, when the war started, had a whole lot of naval presence on either of the lakes. And you had to build those ships and get them into battle very, very quickly.
Okay. All right, interesting. In terms of Britain attacking us, learning about overseas with Napoleon's defeat in Russia, quasi-defeat, because he just kept advancing and...
No, it was a defeat. Well, he just went in with over 500,000, came out with, what, 50,000?
Yeah, but the Russians just kept backing up and backing up and backing up. He got to Moscow, it was on fire. He lost out a lot of his troops there, and then he was pushed back.
Are you trying to say he wasn't defeated?
I'm just throwing it out there. He just ran out of resources. It was a bad call, and slowly the army started attacking when he was in retreat. Oh, yeah, just, anyways, sidetrack.
Okay.
Yeah. So the premise that the Americans started with at the time, when the War of 1812 started, is like Britain is occupied overseas.
Yes.
Started to go away.
Yes,
it did. Because now Britain was like, we're beating Napoleon, so now we can shift a lot of our resources back to...
Especially at sea.
That leads us into the attack on Washington, D.C. So you talked in the podcast about the attack in Maryland and about how they just quickly demolished any opposition at all.
Yes.
And the advance toward the Capitol. So they were exercising the same military strategy that we were trying to when we burned York, right? They were just like, we can get to the Capitol. Their stated intention wasn't to burn it. Right.
No. Okay. It was to ransom it.
Okay.
They wanted to capture it and then get the Americans to pay money to get it back.
But that didn't happen because they couldn't find anybody to actually speak with.
Yes, and the federal government's broke at this point, and there's some question as to whether or not the states would have contributed money to get the national capital back, because the states at this point, especially New England, hate the national government. They'd probably be like, burn it.
Yeah.
We don't care.
So why didn't that defeat us?
Because America is so decentralized at this point that the loss of our capital was no big deal. Madison and the government managed to escape, so the War and Navy Department buildings were burned, but the officials are still there. And because the country's so decentralized, there's no semblance of modern communication. The armies that are still in the field fighting are not talking to the War Department. The War Department has almost zero control over the field armies. The War Department, up until the Mexican War, all they did was provide supplies. It was the field commanders who actually ran the war on their own. So really, America's fighting four wars at the same time that we just call the umbrella War of 1812.
Mm-hmm. So they didn't even know that the Capitol had burned.
They either knew or it did not affect their...
Because their mindset was not like, this capital is the symbol of our democracy.
Oh, no.
Okay.
No. I mean, remember, Washington, D.C. is much different back then. It's the White House, it's the Capitol building, and it's a few other government buildings, and then it's a shanty town that surrounds it. It's a city of maybe, I think, 10,000 people.
Wow.
Instead of the 2.5 million who live in the greater Washington area today. Mm-hmm. I think it's 2.5 million. It was kind of like, okay, we'll get it back eventually.
Yeah.
So, they burned the White House, they burned the Capitol building, everything but the patent office.
Which is kind of ironic.
Well, yeah, I mean, they wanted to keep their patents.
So, why don't we talk about the Battle of Baltimore? You talked about in the podcast the fact that the British underestimated the defenders.
Yes.
So, why did they do that, and how were the defenders able to hold out?
Mm-hmm. They assumed that because Washington fell so easily... Every American city would fall so easily, but Washington has one critical difference compared to every other city in America. It is not part of a larger state. There is very little loyalty toward the national government at this point. America is still seen by many of its citizens as an alliance of states. It would be like the UN General Assembly building being destroyed. And that is that going to, you know, arouse a huge outcry in America? Probably not. Because it's the headquarters of an alliance. It's not a huge deal. The citizens of Maryland were like, we don't care we care, but we're not going to do too much to defend Washington. Oh, but they've stepped foot on our soil, and they're going to destroy our largest city? Not happening. And so militiamen, federal soldiers, rose up as one, manned the barricades, and held out. Pride not for their country, but for their state.
Interesting.
And it's that kind of attitude that will continue up until the Civil War. It's the Civil War that ultimately kind of changes the image of the United States as being an alliance of states to being one nation. That's why it's the United States are versus the United States is.
So let's talk about Andrew Jackson, the Battle of New Orleans.
Outstanding, yes. Yeah,
so a couple of things about his story stood out to me from the podcast. Pickled in a barrel of rum stands out to me.
Yes.
The position he took on the narrow strip of land stood out to me.
Mm-hmm.
And the
positioning of his guns?
Yeah.
Was that in the podcast? I don't think it was.
No, it's just...
aiming the guns a little lower, that whole thing?
No. Can you elaborate on that? Please.
He's like, walking along.
Because you laid out the battlefield well,
yeah,
and the outcome well, but yeah, what happened?
So Andrew Jackson hates the British with the heat of a thousand suns, because during the Revolution, he as a young boy, maybe 5 or 6, was slashed by a British soldier in the face because he refused to clean the soldier's boots. And under British military law, you could do that if a civilian refused to.
So slashed by a sword in the face?
By a sword in the face. If you look at portraits from Andrew Jackson, they're always of only one side. You only get one side of his face because he has incredible scarring on the other side of his face, and he was ashamed of that. And so for the rest of his life, he hated the British. So when it comes to the positioning in the Battle of New Orleans, he's walking along the defenses of the defensive line, and he sees his soldiers ready to go, and he sees the cannons ready and the muskets loaded and everything, and he shouts jokingly to the soldiers, aim those guns a little lower, because he wants to shoot British soldiers not in the head or in the chest, but a little bit lower.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So how is he able to win?
Better tactics. Like most of the military topics we've had in the last two seasons, the man with the better tactics wins. He understood that a defensive wall, a ton of cannons double loaded with grape shot, and just the sheer ferociousness of the French band of pirates that he had, the freed slaves, the prisoners that he had loosed from the jails in New Orleans, and the militiamen who were eager to finally get into this war, was going to overwhelm the British.
Gotcha. And the pickled in a barrel of rum?
That was actually that was standard practice.
It was?
Yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah.
But he picked out Wellington's favorite vintage.
Folks, that's an example of trolling back in the day.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
But by that time, the war had ended, and he didn't even know it.
Ironically,
yet.
Yeah.
Do you think that he would have cared? He would just have been like, nope, they're here, I'm gonna
fight. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I'm going to fight.
Yeah, when your enemy's in front of you, you take him down. Especially if you're Andrew Jackson, the man who fought, I think, 48 duels in his life.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Carried a bullet in his chest, very close to his heart, for about 30 years.
Yeah.
Most of them because his wife's honor was being questioned. Most of his duels were fought for that reason. Not someone you messed with.
Was her integrity questionable?
She had been divorced before he married. Not her fault. Her husband had cheated and left her.
I'm saying it's her fault.
The image back then was it didn't matter. And so Andrew Jackson married a divorced woman. Oh, huge scandal. And anytime any of his political opponents would question her virtue or anything like that.
Sounds like the conversation didn't last long.
It usually led to the gauntlet being thrown down and then bullets flying and then Jackson walking over the corpse of his former enemy.
In terms of the lasting peace, all things as they were before the war. That's an interesting way to end a war.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Like, was America...
Because neither side really had an advantage. America's exhausted. Britain's exhausted. Let's just go back to what it was beforehand. We'll just pretend the war didn't happen.
But there was a consequence in terms of American-British relations. We didn't want to have anything to do with them for a great long time, right?
True.
And we kind of dismissed ourselves from all foreign affairs.
We did. And Britain supported us in that dismissal.
Yeah.
Britain did not want to be involved in any more colonial affairs in the United or in the New World and didn't want any other European powers there either.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think we all understand what would have happened if Britain had won the war, possibly. But in terms of us winning the war, it was like the war never happened.
Mm-hmm.
Despite, like, even though capital was burned, thousands and thousands of people had died. All these things, just kind of step back from it and be like, what was the point of that?
It was really, as I said at the end of the podcast, to gain true freedom from outside influence.
Okay.
From the time of the Glorious Revolution in 1688 and the war that started in 1689, all the way through to the end of the Napoleonic Wars in 1815. That's 120 plus years. the 13 colonies and then the United States has been constantly dragged, pulled, kicking and screaming into European affairs, and we are sick of it. And this war, maybe that was not the intention at its outset, but that's what this war did. It finally got us free of European politics, European entanglements, and for the next century, with very minor interludes, we are going to say, that's your side of the world, you deal with your problems, this is our side of the world, we'll deal with our issues here, our problems here.
Which we had many.
We did.
Yeah. And so the
idea... To be discussed in the next couple of podcasts. Yeah,
absolutely. So in terms of us expanding our influence on our continent and dealing with our own problems, wouldn't have been good to be involved in anybody else's problems at the same time.
Yep.
Thank you for joining us in our discussion of Blundering into War, the War of 1812. I'm Joe Parker.
And I'm John Streeter.
Be sure to leave us a review on iTunes. It really does help. Thanks, and see you next week.